You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
They're saying I should think stuff. Something is wrong with me.
Get to be so cynical.
Practice.
Yes, this is the 100th edition episode of Positive Cynicism, and normally, due to the scheduling of the week of the month in which this falls, my co-host would be Eric Bennett. We were going to be talking cinema of 1999, and I teased on the last episode with Eric that I would have a special guest for this episode. Unfortunately, Eric is a little under the weather this week and was not able to be here, so I had to make a few phone calls, send some wire transfers, and get another special guest, and I figured it was only fitting to have this guest on the 100th episode. Please welcome from My 123 Cents, the podcast, another show here on Jittery Monkey, Mr. Kevin Hudensberger. I guess you would be our wrestling expert, so Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. And I know there were probably some groans, you know, the anticipation of a special guest for episode 100. And then it's like, that guy. It's kind of like, some of the disappointments that we'll be talking about, I'm sure, that are associated with wrestling in the year 1999. But I am glad to be a part of this. And congratulations, by the way, on 100 episodes. That's awesome.
Yeah, I did think we would get here eventually, and we should have gotten here a little bit faster. But that first year of Positive Cynicism was, that was a learning curve, and I didn't have guest hosts at the time. And there were a lot of times where I didn't even want to listen to myself speak, so we didn't do a show. But now we're here, and it is the month of 1999 here in July of 2019. And I figured because there is an extra month or an extra week in the month of July that I needed a special show, bring you on, because in the wrestling world, 2019 and 1999, I think, are going to be very similar in some regards.
It is very interesting how some of the power players that are getting back into the business in 2019 were kind of in those roles or similar roles in 1999, and how 20 years, how some things have changed, but ultimately at the end of the day, I think a lot of things have stayed pretty much the same.
Yes, it's like Spinal Tap says, the less things change, the more they stay the same.
That is true.
So let's kind of hop in the DeLorean time machine telephone booth and go back to 1999. At the time, you had two major wrestling promotions, WWF, now WWE, and WCW. And then you had ECW, which was your kind of fringe, diehard wrestling promotion. And the WWE and WCW had been having what they called the Monday Night War, no S.
Singular, yes. Thank you.
For a few years. You could say that, WCW launched Nitro in, I believe, this fall of 95?
It was September of 95, yeah.
Yeah, September 95. But then it really kicked in Memorial Day of 1996 when Scott Hall showed up. And then eventually a couple weeks later, Kevin Nash showed up fresh off of being with WWF. And then I believe we're recording this on July 7th. I believe we're one day removed from the official formation of the New World Order at the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view in 1997.
Actually, 96. As we record this, July 7th, 1996 is the actual anniversary. So, yeah, okay. We are recording on the anniversary of it.
Okay. So 23 years ago. I don't know numbers. If I don't have them written down in front of me.
Well, they're irrelevant in the podcast.
Exactly. That's why I don't pay attention to them. But so the New World Order was formed, and this really kickstarted WCW to be like the cool faction the cool promotion that everybody was watching for at least 83 weeks.
Right.
Yeah. And then WWF kind of, they had the players in that would lead to their success down the road, but they weren't utilizing them to their full potential. So let's fast forward to 2019 real quick. You have All Elite Wrestling, which is a new promotion that is going to be launching a new show probably in September or October that will be on TNT, the same station that hosted Nitro.
Yes.
You have WWE, which is, you know, they've got a lot of talent, but a lot of it's not being utilized the way fans would like it to be.
Yeah.
But, and they have just recently named Eric Bischoff, former head of WCW, and Paul Heyman, former head of ECW, as executive producers of their Monday Night Raw and Tuesday Night SmackDown, which will be moving to Fridays once it moves to Fox in the fall. So that's where you're saying they brought back the major players from 20 years ago to deal with a new upstart who WCW was bankrolled by billionaire Ted Turner, and now AEW is going to be bankrolled by billionaire Tony Khan, who also owns the Jacksonville Jaguars. What do you think, because, you know, there's already talk of the new war, even though I don't believe AEW show will be going up against either Monday Night Raw or SmackDown. Do you see this as an actual war in the sense that we had it back in 1999, or do you think fans are just clamoring for something, so they're making it out to be bigger than it is?
I think, well, a lot of things in pro wrestling especially, we as fans want it to be more than it's going to probably ultimately end up being. You know, I do think that hiring Eric Bischoff and Paul Heyman and putting them into these roles of executive directors for Raw and SmackDown respectively is maybe not necessarily a preemptive strike, but it is certainly a smart move. I think WWE for probably the last 10 or 15 years at least has gotten too much on the entertainment side of things and has focused by bringing in more writers, which I've always maintained wrestling or professional wrestling needs more wrestling people involved with it than entertainers. But Eric Bischoff, I think, is an enigma in that he has experience with both. So I think having him run things over on SmackDown Live, especially when it goes to Fox, and he knows how to kind of deal with networks and television. And I know ultimately both men, Heyman and Bischoff, are going to answer to Vince McMahon. However, I think that, I don't know, I just feel like their visions, I feel like, could work, especially because so many fans have clamored for so long to break away from this current quote-unquote PG era that we're in and kind of go back and take us back to the Attitude Era. And, you know, part of 1999, a big part of 1999, was a lot of that kind of Smash Mouth television. You know, I call it short attention span theater, because wrestling fans, I feel like so much was being thrown at us in 99 that, you know, we've talked about it before. We could sit here and recite those early years of WrestleMania without looking at the internet to get the matches. But once we kind of get into that Attitude Era and there are so many pay-per-views and so many events and so much competition, it's hard to recall and remember all of it, because it's just boom, 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 one right after the other. And I, you know, doing some research for this show, I've remembered some things that I had forgotten about.
Yeah, and it's stuff that even while researching, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember this. But if you had asked me what year did this take place, I would not have been able to tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, going with Bischoff and Heyman's hiring, yes, both of these guys had success in different various levels when they ran ECW and WCW. Do you think, though, because both of those promotions went out of business in 2001, which is almost 20 years ago, you know, Paul Heyman since then has been off and on WWE creative. Eric Bischoff did work with WWE. I don't believe he ever worked in a creative role. And a lot of critics of Eric Bischoff will say that he's not really creative at all. He just takes other people's ideas. I think he has a good business sense for dealing with network and dealing with a corporate structure, more so than Heyman does.
Right.
But do you think, let's take Vince McMahon out of the equation. because as you said, they're going to be answering to him. The final product will have to go through him and he'll have to approve everything. But do you think Paul Heyman and Eric Bischoff are the ones that can, in a sense, capture lightning in a bottle twice? Like, because we saw Eric Bischoff and Hulk Hogan come into power in with TNA, now Impact Wrestling, in 2010. And for lack of a better term, they shit the bed because they kind of made wanted to make it more like do everything that they did back in the 90s. And even watching old ECW, which I loved at the time, I don't think that promotion would work today given where we are as a society. So my question is, do you think Heyman and Bischoff will be able to pull off entertaining and relevant storylines or action for today's audience?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and it is hard to answer that taking Vince McMahon out of the equation, because he will, you know, inevitably, until I think he draws his last breath, be making those final decisions. I do think that we all, you know, you and I obviously are not the same men that we were 20 years ago. I don't think that Eric Bischoff and Paul Heyman are the same men that they were 20 years ago. And listening to 83 Weeks, the podcast, I think Eric Bischoff has become a much more humble individual, and he has taken ownership for some of the mistakes that were made along the way. So I do think that he still has a good mind and a good sense for not only the wrestling business, but the television side of things as well, which I think will serve him well and will serve WWE well in that capacity. As far as Paul Heyman goes, you know, I do think that when you're not the quote unquote boss, and you know, Heyman had all kinds of things to worry about with money and talent, and you know, I think if those things are kind of off the plate and off the table for them to have to worry about, and they're just focusing on the creative, I think that it takes some of the pressure off and can make things easier. I also think that, you know, they know how to, at least Bischoff specifically in dealing with Fox, will kind of know how to answer with and deal with, because I don't think all of the problems WCW encountered were Eric Bischoff's problems, or you know, that that corporate structure coming down from working for Ted Turner, and you know, there were so many legalities and whatnot. And you know, with WWE, it just seems like it gets past USA and then it's on the air. But there was so much infighting within the Turner organization that, you know, CNN or whatever those other networks were, didn't want to you know, it was that embarrassing wrestling company that was part of the family, so to speak. So I think once you get away from that kind of stuff, it makes it easier to do your job. And I think that 20 years later, I think professional wrestling or sports entertainment has become more acceptable on a larger scale. It's more mainstream, and I don't think it's necessarily the taboo that it was 20 years ago, especially if you take out some of the backyard antics and some of the you know, the more extreme hardcore stuff that they were doing 20 years ago.
Yeah, if you want a good background on all the issues with WCW that went on behind the scenes, I highly recommend the book Nitro, The Incredible Rise and Inevitable Collapse of Ted Turner's WCW by Guy Evans. It's a very interesting read. And I think part of, you know, with Eric Bischoff, part of his thing too is with coming back into the fold in WWE is he's not going to be, like you said, offering contracts. So he's not going to have to be dealing with the ego or, you know, all the guys that had guaranteed contracts and wouldn't and creative control or didn't want to do things that they suggested. And Heyman has always been good at working around hiding people's shortcomings. And like you said, so yeah, I think, I'm part of me is very hesitant to have them back into a creative position because of the time has changed and wrestling has changed from when they were last in charge. But at the same time, I think if you take away, as you mentioned, strip them down to where all they have to do is come up with good ideas, and then hopefully we'll see something, see a better product. And even, it, you know, you look at WWE today, and as I said, they have a wealth of talent. And it's not so much that the matches are bad. It's just the presentation and the storytelling makes very yeah. little sense.
And that's where I think bringing in guys with, you know, that background and knowledge helps, because I don't know the makeup of creative now, but I know that, you know, there was a period there where they had Freddie Prinze Jr., for example, and not a knock against him. He's a fan, but he's not been in there, and you know what I mean? And I think it goes beyond just being a fan, but you have to also have some, at least have some knowledge of the product. And I know, you know, WWE lately has been posting openings for writers or assistants and whatnot. A lot of it, you know, says a knowledge of the product, because I do think they went through a time there where it was more of just the Hollywood types that they could come in and write episodic television and not necessarily worry about storylines, and that would just come with the territory. And I think taking it back to that intimate knowledge of the business, or at least of what's going on, is crucial.
Well, speaking of the business, let's again jump back to 1999. And, you know, in doing my research for this episode, which for you loyal listener out there, very little limited research this week because this episode was kind of thrown together. I talked to Kevin about doing this episode, but we were supposed to do it in about 2 weeks. But instead we had about 2 hours to plan for this episode. But in the
This week's My 1-2-3 Cents episode. So we just are doing it sooner than I had anticipated.
Yeah, exactly. But in my research, I found an article that talked about 1999 being the worst year for wrestling. And some of the stuff that they mentioned, I'm like, okay, yeah, this was probably one of, there was a lot of bad in 1999. Like I said, this was, WCW was starting, which had built up the great NWO feud in 1996, and all the way through 97. After Starrcade 97, the match between Sting and Hulk Hogan, which had been built up for about 15 months and did not go off the way that it probably should have. 98 was kind of the downturn, and then 99 was kind of quickly going off the cliff, which you would think that they couldn't have fallen any further, but as we'll see as we discuss this, no, by late 99 and 2000, they were falling even faster.
Yeah.
Yeah, but 1999 starting, so talking about guys with business sense, I believe Kevin Nash at this time was the booker in WCW, and they started off WCW in, or Monday Nitro in January, with what has been known, I'm going to try a whole different word because I don't think I can pronounce that one, but has the finger poke of doom is, if you say that to any wrestling fan who is watching through the Monday Night War, they know instantly what you're talking about.
And yeah.
That was when Bill Goldberg was supposed to get his rematch for the WCW title against Kevin Nash. He was taken out of the match because he was arrested for stalking Miss Elizabeth and was at the police station next door. So instead, Hulk Hogan makes his return after a few months off and faces Kevin Nash for the title. And Hogan just gives him a finger poke in the chest. Nash falls down. Hogan becomes champion. And I think that was probably one of the first. I think Goldberg losing the way that he did at Starrcade 98 didn't mm-hmm. help, but then this finger poke of doom really kind of set WCW on a downward spiral, to where fans were kind of over the shenanigans of the NWO.
Yeah, and just for a little bit more context, the very last time that Nitro, because as Chad mentioned early into this episode, Raw and Nitro, you know, competed for several years going back and forth, and then there was a stretch of 83 weeks that Nitro beat Raw consecutively. Well, then Raw took back over right around WrestleMania 14 time. Now, they lost to Nitro for the very last time, Raw did, on October 26th, 1998. And then after that, Raw never lost again until buying out WCW in 2001. So the finger poke of doom, you know, I do have that in my notes as well. And that is definitely, by 99, even, you know, the whole point of turning Hogan heel in 96 was because the red and yellow had gone stale. Well, I think by 99... the NWO was losing its steam. And I also would attribute a lot of this, a lot of the reason why I think fans look at these years is kind of, we look at it kind of through rose-colored glasses in some senses, but then also calling it, you know, 99 the worst year in wrestling, because we're 4 years into this war and we are getting pay-per-view level matches each week on Raw or Nitro. And then, as we'll talk later, SmackDown and Thunder. And then you also have monthly pay-per-views. It offers up a lot of potential for viewer fatigue. And I fear that between AEW, WWE, NXT, Impact Wrestling, Ring of Honor, MLW, all these other promotions in 2019, I wonder if we're going to go through a similar time as we get later into 2019 here with the viewer.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I mean, even in 1999, when you had just Monday Night Raw, which was 2 hours, and Monday Nitro, which was two, I believe expanded to three in 1999, that's still not as much wrestling as what we have now. And like you said, SmackDown did come along, and then Thunder came along later in 99 as well. But now you have so many different promotions, and like I said, one of my problems with the amount of indie promotions that are easily accessible today than, you know, that we didn't have access to in the past, is that a lot of them use the same talent. And I think that's going to be a key in trying to keep promotions fresh, because then I don't know what type of deal AEW is going to have with their talent. I would expect them not to be able to use Ring of Honor or MLW or Impact talent for on television.
Right.
But if they're using all these other guys that can still do PWG, AAW, AIW, and all these other promotions across the country, it's, why am I going to keep searching out these promotions just to see the same wrestlers that I see otherwise? Yeah, that will be the interesting take. But going back to the finger poke of doom, yes, that was a bad start for WCW. But then WCW or WWE did not capitalize immediately off of that, because they gave us probably the worst Royal Rumble pay-per-view just a few weeks later. And it's a Royal Rumble where Vince McMahon won, throwing Stone Cold. He and Stone Cold Steve Austin were number one and two, and they fought most of the match outside of the ring, in the concourse, in the bathroom. And a lot of what happened in the ring was guys that you knew had no chance of winning the Rumble. And it was just...
Go ahead. I was going to say that year was definitely a two-man Rumble. And you and I have talked about this off recording devices before. It really is probably the worst Royal Rumble, at least that comes to mind if someone were to say what is the worst Royal Rumble, I would have 99, if not number one, it would definitely be in my top three or four for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then even a few months later, WrestleMania 15 was probably the most Vince Russo-y show, or at least the most Vince Russo of WrestleMania, because you had the Road Dogg, who had been fighting for the Hardcore Championship, now going into the match as the Intercontinental Champion. Billy Gunn, who's his Road Dogg's tag team partner, who had been trying to win the IC title, won the Hardcore title. And I believe 15, let's see, am I correct in remembering 15 is Boss Man, Undertaker? Or is that 14?
Yes.
Okay, so 15 you have Hell in a Cell, Boss Man, Undertaker, where Big Boss Man gets hung or hanged or hang, whatever the proper verbiage is, at the end of the match. And yeah, it's just a bad. And then one of the things that I go back to as a fan who enjoyed the Attitude Era during its time, but will now look back and say it wasn't that great. Your main event was Steve Austin and The Rock, which is good and was the logical main event for that year. But then that's like they wrestled at 15, 17, and 19, I believe. So that was a match that, you know, WWE couldn't come up with any other main event other than when next year at 16, Steve Austin's out injured. WrestleMania 18 is when Hulk Hogan came back. So you got the Hulk The Rock match, which was like two generations meaning. But had those two events not happened, I wonder if we would have got Rock and Austin for a third or fourth time, or fourth or fifth time.
Yeah, it just, I think at that point it was getting to where both companies were getting comfortable. WWE, I feel like, did a better job of creating and building that new talent because, as you mentioned, you know, The Rock went from Rocky Maivia to The Rock. Steve Austin, you know, obviously got the push. And by 99, they're still kind of creating that new talent. And as much as we tend to, as fans today, crap on Vince Russo, he also, to his credit, though, seemingly had a story for everyone. So whether it was D'Lo Brown or The Godfather or, you know, the Hardy Boys who made their debut in 99, everybody seemingly had some sort of story and had some reason for being there. Now, it didn't always make sense, but to their credit, they were at least being utilized, which is something that we certainly can't say for today. Now, WCW on that flip side, still in the main event, you've got Hulk Hogan, you've got Kevin Nash, you've got Sting, you've got Lex Luger. You know, Goldberg, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, other than Goldberg and maybe Booker T with Harlem Heat, I don't know that WCW did themselves any favors in creating a new star or a new talent. DDP, Diamond Dallas Page, I guess.
Just getting ready to say DDP. And then, I mean, I don't know if you can throw Rey Mysterio, Chris Jericho, and Dean Malenko, you know, the cruiserweights in there, because they did get focus and they did get the wider audience on the, you know, to see them in WCW, even though they, you know, they had kind of made a name in ECW and, you know, Jericho and Lance Storm were in Smoky Mountain together. But I think WCW was the first real national promotion to give them a chance. But again, that's just letting them go out there and do what they do. It wasn't necessarily making them a star, giving them a good storyline or promoting them as someone to watch. It was just, oh yeah, here's the next cruiserweight match in the first hour of Nitro. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I would agree. That's a good point too. Yeah.
Yeah. And it, you know, you mentioned that the Vince Russo did have a good talent of giving everybody a storyline. And you look at like Monday Night Raw right now, where they have the 24/7 title, which I know a lot of people complained about when it started, but it's becoming one of the more entertaining. And I believe I saw an article a week or so ago that said R-Truth is one of the most popular wrestlers according to like YouTube views now. But you have like every week there's probably at least 10 guys doing nothing except chasing the 24/7 title. And it's like, why aren't these guys being utilized into proper storylines? Why are we getting the same stories week after week? Why can't you know, WWE cycle guys in and out of shows on a weekly basis instead of just giving us the same thing all the way up to the pay-per-view?
Yeah, that's, you know, I mean, if we knew the true answer to that, we'd probably be there working some capacity. But yeah, it's unfortunate that, and I, you know, I think that a lot of it comes down to, and I don't want to go too deep in the woods on this, but, you know, Vince McMahon, WWE, it's now a publicly traded company. It has been actually for 20 years now or very near 20 years. You know, the Saudi Arabia shows, for example. There are caveats that are being laid out there that WWE must follow. And you know, when all this money is on the line and you know, it's not just the Saudi show, but it's USA. You know, USA is the one that wants 3 hours of Raw, mm-hmm. because even when it's the crappiest of shows, it's still the number one rated show on that network. And so, you know, people say, well, ratings are down. They may be down, but they're still the cash cow for USA. And so they make concessions and things have to happen, and they have to do things that, you know, I think that, yeah, I often wonder, maybe Vince McMahon and Triple H and Stephanie hate this too, but they can't do anything about it because while it is their company, they have to follow certain guidelines, whether it be their shareholders or the companies that are providing the television platform for them. So I don't think it's, you know, it goes back and forth, I think. But yes, I do agree. There is a lot of underutilized talent, and I think that's going to only become an even bigger problem as they kind of continue to sign people to stick around.
Which, I guess that's a good segue back into looking at the war between 1999 and 2019, is back in 1999, you had guys jumping back and forth from promotion. You know, we mentioned it started with Scott Hall and Kevin Nash leaving WWF for WCW, and then you know, you had guys, I'm trying to think of who the biggest name, probably off the top of my head, I'm thinking it's X-Pac leaving or getting fired from WCW and showing up the night after WrestleMania 14 in 1997.
98,
I'm sorry. Shawn Michaels lost the title to Steve Austin and then retired for 4 years. X-Pac, formerly Six, came in, rejoined Generation X. Well, and I was just about to say, is there any other big names that jumped? And then I'm like, oh yeah, a guy by the name of The Big Show kind of left in
99. Are we 99? Yeah.
Yeah, and there's this little guy that showed up in August of 1999 that you may have heard of by the name of Chris Jericho.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my mind was really bad on that point I was trying to make. But you look now at, you know, and they said, like, WCW at the time had several wrestlers under contract that never even appeared on television. And now you see, because speculation is because AEW is getting traction, because they're doing well on the shows that they've held so far, WWE is trying to lock guys into 5-year contract, and they recently re-signed Mike Bennett and Maria Kanellis, or Mike and Maria Kanellis, if you will, by their stage names, to 5-year contracts, and they had never been on TV more than probably twice in the last, or probably more than twice, but a handful of times in the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they immediately put them on TV and kind of bury them. We'll see where it goes, but it's this, and I saw something that said WWE between Raw, SmackDown, NXT, NXT UK, have, I think, around 200 guys under contract.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't realize.
Yeah, but you're only seeing, like, the same 20 to 30 guys. And granted, again, with most of it being in NXT, which is a developmental league, or NXT UK, which, you know, is Europe, and so maybe not available for weekly television. But with Dean Ambrose recently leaving WWE and joining AEW as Jon Moxley, do you think we're going to see more guys jumping on? I know there's a lot of speculation of, like, oh, these guys are very unhappy with WWE and they went out, but then suddenly they're signing. You know, the news came out today that the club, Carl Anderson and Luke Gallows, have apparently signed new 5-year contracts. Do you think guys will actually be willing to jump to AEW without the guarantee that they're going to be around in 5 years? Or do you think AEW should even be signing every guy that becomes available?
I don't think that they should sign every guy that becomes available, or woman for that matter, because I think they will fall into that stigma that Impact Wrestling has or had at one point, where they became WWE light. I think that it's reassuring, though, if you are a wrestler, a superstar, that there is that plan B. And I think that goes both ways. I think that AEW will have talent that will go to WWE, and I think that there will be talent from WWE that will go to AEW. AEW, though, would be wise, and I think that I'm going to assume that they know this already, but to not sign everyone, and that's where it's going to get interesting, I think, in the fall once this program starts, because everybody's kumbaya, and, you know, the Bucks and Cody and Kenny and you know, they all are buddies and friends and whatnot. But, you know, as they say, the shit's going to get real. And, you know, if there's pressure from TNT, if ratings are down or, you know, whatever it may be, there's going to be I don't want to say that they don't know what they're doing and they think this is going to be easy. I think that they are prepared for what it's going to take. But I also think that there's going to be a lot of disgruntled fans who are living in this world of, you know, AEW right now can do no wrong. And I think that the first time something happens or they're, you know, whether it's bound by what TNT standards are or that, you know, their creative direction changes to flow with a mainstream audience, because as I've talked about before, not everyone's going to have access to TNT. You know, if people have cut cable or satellite or whatever, it's, you know, and I'm sure there will be ways to stream it and whatnot. But I just think that that first go around where the customer is not going to be happy, it's going to be interesting to see how the internet treats that. But I think that, you know, they really need to work on continuing to define that brand. And, you know, as much as I love Jim Ross, you know, I don't know that he is, you know, I listen to him on his podcast and I hear him talk about AEW. I'm still hearing the guy that, you know, was the soundtrack of the last 20 years of, I say 20 years, but, you know, the last however long he was doing Raw. I mean, he was the voice of that show, and I can't help but continue to associate him with WWE, even though I know he is no longer there.
Yeah, that's another valid point of, you know, talking about signing all the any ex-WWE wrestlers and getting the perception of WWE light with Jim Ross there. I think that's another point where I think having Jim Ross under contract and being able to help the announcers would be a good idea. But him being the voice, I mean, I'll admit his commentary at the last AEW show, Double or Nothing, I was not impressed with. I think he, I don't know if it's just not being familiar with the talent or, and which could change once he's doing a weekly show. But I think it's also that thing where you're, like you said, if a casual fan is flipping around and hear him, yes, it may help to keep that fan interested because they're like, oh, I know JR. Okay, let me see what this is. But mm-hmm. It's also going to get that stigma of, oh, is this another Vince McMahon company? And I think AEW would have been better to go with announcers who had no ties to any previous promotion. I think Excalibur, even though he does Pro Wrestling Guerrilla commentary, you know, how many people actually watch their DVDs or stream their stuff on highspots.com? You know, I think he's a fresh voice, and I'm sure there are other announcers out there, Kevin Huntsberger, who could be doing this. Yeah, I worked a little cheap plug-in for you.
Yeah, well, thank you. No, yeah, and that, you know, that's a perfectly valid point, too. You know, you want to have that familiarity, but you also want to be careful that you don't become that competition, if you will. And like you said, you know, it's kind of like, and I know Conrad, I don't remember, I do listen to every Conrad Thompson podcast. I can't remember which one he was talking about this on, but it becomes that that brand identity where it's not wrestling, it's WWE. Mm-hmm. It's not a Kleenex, it's really a tissue, or it's not Xerox, it's a copy machine. There's so much out there that we just tag that brand with the product. And I still think, even with AEW, I don't see the mainstream media, you know, covering AEW events per se, like, you know, back in the late 90s when Dennis Rodman and Karl Malone were involved with WCW and Mike Tyson is working WWE, you know, they got that attention. And I don't know, it's going to be an interesting ride for sure with AEW. And I do think we'll see some of the same similarities that we saw 20 years ago. Do you know, is AEW going to have it? Will the show be live?
I believe so. But until they officially announce anything, I take any speculation with a grain of salt. But I would, I would assume if you have a major network and you have a billionaire financing your company, that you're going to be live, because that's pretty much the only way to do a weekly show. I mean, I know Impact and Ring of Honor, you know, they tape their shows in a month in advance or whatever, but I think that's because it's cheaper to do it that way for those companies, whereas...
Yeah.
And speaking of those companies, because we talked about talent going from AEW to WWE and vice versa, but you know, back in 99 you also had guys that had made their name in ECW jumping to WCW, mostly the cruiserweights, Rey Mysterio, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Jericho, to name a few. And then, you know, eventually guys started going to WWE as well, or WWF. But you know, in today's market, where Impact Wrestling seems to have guys tied up for, you know, a lot of the undercard guys, it seems, are only there for like 6 months, because they tape a couple months every few months, and then it seems like guys are leaving more frequently and then coming back later. But with that company, and then with Ring of Honor, having talent that is not on the level necessarily name brand wise that has been there in the past, do you see those guys either falling by the wayside or getting a chance with WWE and AEW, or are those, I guess, as Impact and Ring of Honor going to be kind of the home for guys that are, I hate saying it this way because I don't want to disrespect anyone, but who are good but not that good?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a great point. Unfortunately, I think that, you know, as this quote unquote war fires up, I do think some of the casualties will be companies like Ring of Honor and Impact specifically. You know, Impact has been reeling for a time. Again, great product. They've got a lot of talent there, but they don't have that home. And I think that 2019, even though many of us are streaming and whatnot, I do think you have to have that TV home base to be taken seriously. Ring of Honor, of course, is in syndication. I couldn't tell you how many times, I could count on one hand probably how many times I've actually stayed up late enough to watch it or have caught it in the middle of the afternoon on a Saturday.
Well, and real quick, Ring of Honor is owned by Sinclair Broadcasting, which recently made a deal with Fox to buy the Fox Sports networks in some regard. So I'm wondering, you know, are they going to put Ring of Honor on those networks? But again, it will be something like what, I mean, because at a time Impact was on Fox Sports, but it got bounced around a lot. It was in the afternoon and it got bounced around if there were live sports coverage, which also doesn't help build an audience if they never know when you're on.
Right. Yeah. I know that about Sinclair. That's interesting.
Yeah. And like I said, Impact has been really good for the last year and a half, ever since Dixie Carter sold the company and stopped tearing it down with her stupid ideas. But they just don't have, you know, I mean, like right now, I've cut cable. I don't have the channel on YouTube TV, which is what I use. The Pursuit channel is not on there. The Pursuit app on the Roku device does not have previous episodes of Impact. Impact does have a streaming service like the WWE Network that I could pay for and watch the shows, but then that goes back into kind of what we were discussing before the show about AEW having all their YouTube videos. And it's like, setting aside time to kind of come in and watch something on a different platform is, it's not hard. It's just not something that I think of to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, I mean, that, and the other point, you know, we're two mid 40-year-old guys talking about a product that, you know, really is being aimed at guys that were our age 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, in 99, we were that demo that WWE and WCW and ECW, for that matter, were looking for. So, you know, I guess we have to kind of, in that perspective as well, you know, would Chad Smart and Kevin Huntsberger today in 2019 have been as into WWF and WCW, you know, if it were the Attitude Era happening right now? Mm-hmm. Would we have cared as much? Because we have life, you know, we have other things going on that we can't sit and watch and consume. And now, as you mentioned, you know, there's these Twitter wars that are happening between some of the wrestlers, and I don't follow all the rest, you know, so I don't know some of the backstories, and some of them are like referencing it in commentary, you know, oh, well, so-and-so said this about such and such on Twitter yesterday. And it's like, okay, you know, and you have to, that's where I think that TV is important still, and kind of explaining and laying it all out, because I can commit 2 hours and watch a show, or, you know, stream it or DVR it and zip through it at my leisure. But I can't sit there and go watch 3 or 4 YouTube videos and then understand what's going on, and then, you know, listen to this podcast or watch this bonus episode or whatever it may be. And I am exaggerating a bit, but it is getting to the point where it's hard to keep up with everyone, especially now that we're throwing AEW into a weekly situation and a weekly scenario soon as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I have the independentwrestling.tv app on my Roku, which has several different promotions and does live broadcast as well. But it's that same thing where, you know, indie shows go 3-4 hours sometimes. And it's like taking that time to sit down and watch a show, especially if it's a bunch of guys that I don't know. And that's where one of the things with AEW, like, I like that they're signing some fresh talent that I'm not familiar with, but so far they haven't done a good job on their pay-per-view of telling me who these people are. Mm-hmm. And same way with, so watching all these independent shows, you know, there's, again, good wrestling. I don't want to discredit any of the actual performers, but there's just such a gluttony of material out there. And like you said, if you're trying to track down Twitter feeds, YouTube videos, this and that, it is a bit much. And again, maybe we're just old and our attention spans don't work the way the younger generation does. But yeah, you mentioned being 20 years, you know, 20 years ago when we were in our 20s in the Attitude Era, and I had a thought that I was going to jump off on that, but I have no idea what it was now because I'm old and I lose thoughts pretty quickly.
And I ramble, so that doesn't help.
We're going to have fun at the old folks' home.
But, you know, to me, 1999 was also defining in a couple of other ways. And I know you and Travis Yates kind of talked about this, and I don't want to steer your conversation, so take us back on course. But obviously the death of Owen Hart, I think, was very impactful, and changed a lot of things, I think, in terms of what kinds of stunts, quote unquote stunts, that companies were trying to get away with back then.
Yeah, I mean, I believe Sting still rappelled from the ceiling or rappelled from a helicopter on the Spring Break Nitro. I could be wrong. I'd have to check that out. But yeah, definitely, I think, you know, I can look back and say hopefully that the Owen Hart tragedy did kind of wake people up to be like, okay, look, we're dealing with wrestlers. We're not dealing with stuntmen. So let's, you know, but then at the same time, you had the rise in backyard wrestling becoming a popular thing. And I was telling you about you know, before we started recording, July 4th, Game Changer Wrestling, which is another indie promotion, ran by Joey Janela, who works for AEW, they did a backyard show, and it was, because I was home and bored, I broke down and ordered it, and it was just like a late 1990s backyard show, where it's in somebody's backyard, there's probably 40 people standing around watching. And this will be disrespectful to everyone that was there. It looked like the stereotypical wrestling crowd that you would expect to see. Mm-hmm. One match was Logan Stunt and Marco Stunt, who are brothers, you kind of know them.
Yeah.
They wrestle in Cape Championship Wrestling in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, but you know, they're out there hitting each other with light tubes and doing Canadian destroyers, or they called it the Mississippi destroyer, into a pool. And it's just like one of these things where it's like, what is the point of this? Because of this, and I'm going to sound like Jim Cornette here, this isn't wrestling. This is just people on the Canadian destroyer front, or Mississippi destroyer, it's people having fun in their backyard. And with the light tube stuff, it's just, where is the fascination in that wrestling? And I guess, you know, going back to 2005, I think it was, you and I had a lovely dinner at Applebee's with a guy by the name of Ian Rotten.
Yes.
And and we brought up deathmatch wrestling, and probably did not endear ourselves to Ian very well when we said, what is the point of deathmatch wrestling? And then a few weeks later, watched him have a barbed wire match. So... Okay.
Yeah, you and I agree 100% on that one. I know some of our guys in Stride and other companies will go and do those kinds of matches, and it's just not my cup of tea. You know, if they want to do that, go for it. I don't want to, like, even you were sending me some shots after. I didn't even want to look at it. That kind of stuff just does not appeal to me. That. You know, I realize and I appreciate that in professional wrestling, there is always that inherent danger of being hurt. I don't understand why anyone would want to amplify that risk with a light tube or a bag of thumbtacks or a barbed wire baseball bat or explosions or whatever else, throwing themselves off of roofs and all that crazy stuff. I just don't get why you would want to increase that risk.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I think this will be like where someone like you and I, who are not only fans of wrestling, but also, I guess, decent human beings in a sense, as opposed to someone who isn't a fan of wrestling, who doesn't understand, you know, the type of person who will casually throw out the word fake when discussing wrestling. But I understand that wrestling is predetermined. I don't need you to actually injure yourself for my entertainment. And that's why even watching a ladder match or... you know, any type of non-basic wrestling match, I kind of cringe at some of the stuff that they do, because, you know, you just keep upping the bar to be like, okay, you did this in that match. Well, I have to top that. And, you know, look at the Hell in the Cell matches where, you know, the second one started with Mick Foley being thrown off the top. Now what do they do? Because fans are like, well, that happened in that match, so I need something of that level or that caliber in every match now.
Yeah, you're exactly right, and that's, you know, that's another good point. You know, from that, I think that's a result of that Monday Night War era. We are watching it every week now, and we are watching it on pay-per-view. And, you know, then later in 99, in August of 99, when SmackDown makes its debut, now WWE has 4 hours of weekly programming, and WCW still has the 5 hours with Nitro and Thunder, which had come out the year before that. So it's that constant, we must do more to get your attention and, you know, to keep the fans glued to their seats. And, you know, and I guess I'm going to sound like a hypocrite here, but, you know, the Foley stunt, I say stunt, the Foley Undertaker Hell in a Cell thing, I mean, it's one of the most memorable things from that era, I think, still. And part of it was the visual of it, but also, you know, that voice that Jim Ross calling that and keeping us glued to our TVs when it was going down. So,
yeah, and it's also memorable because it was the first. Because you look at, you know, following Hell in the Cell matches. I mean, would Rikishi being thrown off the top of the roof and landing in the flatbed truck come up in your memory if I didn't mention it?
Right.
You know, you look at WrestleMania 32 with Shane McMahon falling off the top of the cell through the announce table. Like, those lose the impact after a while if that's mm-hmm. what you're getting every single time.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to do it for our look back. I think we kind of talked about 1999 and compared to 2019 in a decent manner. I don't know. You tell me. Again, that's Kevin Hunsberger. You can find him on Twitter at Kevin Hunsberger or at my123cents. You can find me on Twitter at Chad Smart. And Kevin, any last words? Anything you want to say?
Hey, man, I appreciate being a part of the show, you know, being that episode 100. So congrats to you. Thanks to everyone that listens to all the shows here on Jittery Monkey. And keep doing the good, keep up the good work here on Positive Cynicism. It's always fun.
All right. That will be on the newest posters. Ringing endorsements. I don't know. But yes, be sure to check out all the other shows here on Jittery Monkey. And as always, question everything, do something positive.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.